Chapter 21. Within the Stone. The mud of the outer city gave way to paved streets at the walls of Tyr, where the first thing Rant noticed was the absence of guards. Despite the lofty stone ramparts with their towers, the city was less defended than Steading Shangtai, where he and every other human had been gently but firmly refused entrance at first light. Here, the archers' balconies on the towers were empty. The iron-strapped door of the squat gray guardhouse just inside the broad gates stood wide open, and a hard-faced woman in rough woolens, her sleeves shoved up her thin arms, sat there at a wooden tub, scrubbing clothes with a washboard. She appeared to have taken up residence. Two small, grubby children, sucking their thumbs, stared wide-eyed past her at him and his companions. At their horses, at least. Taida Shah was a sight to stare at, a sleek black stallion with a massive chest, a horse that drew attention, yet he had chosen to ride the animal anyway. If the Forsaken could find him as easily as they had at Elgaron's manor house, there was little point to hiding, or at least to putting too much effort into it. He wore black riding gloves to conceal the dragon's heads on his hands and the heron's branded into his palms. His coat was dark gray wool, without a stitch of embroidery, the stallion's saddlecloth simple, and his sword's hilt and scabbard had been covered in unworked boar hide ever since it came into his possession, nothing to pull a second glance. Cadswain, in unadorned gray wool, wore the hood of her dark green cloak well up to shield her Aes Sedai face, but Min, Nynaeve, and Olivia had no need for hiding. Though Min's flower-embroidered red coat and snug breeches might attract a little notice, not to mention her heeled red boots. He had seen women in Kyrian wearing clothes like that, copying her. Yet it seemed unlikely that her fashion had spread to Tyr, where modesty held sway. In public, at least. Nynaeve was wearing yellow-slashed blue silk and all of her jewelry, just partly concealed by her blue cloak, but Tyr would be full of silks. She had wanted to wear her shawl. That was in her saddlebags, though. A little effort only. The second thing he noticed was the sound, a rhythmic racketing clatter, accompanied periodically by a piercing whistle. Faint at first, it seemed to be coming closer rapidly. Despite the early hour, the streets he could see from the gates were crowded. Half the people inside appeared to be sea folk, the men bare-chested, the women in bright linen blouses, all wearing long slashes more colorful than those worn by Tyran commoners. Every head appeared to be turned toward that sound. Children darted through the throng, dodging carts, most often pulled by oxen with wide horns, racing toward the noise. Several well-dressed men and women had dismounted from their sedan chairs and stood with their bearers to watch. A fork-bearded merchant, with silver chains across the chest of his coat, was half out of the window of a red-lacquered coach, shouting at his driver to manage the nervously dancing team while he strained for a better view. White-winged pigeons, startled from pointed slate rooftops by a particularly sharp whistle, suddenly wheeled into the air, and two large flocks crashed into one another, pelting the folk below with stunned birds. Every single bird fell. A few people actually stopped staring toward the approaching noise and gaped at the sky. A surprising number snatched up fallen birds and wrung their necks, though, and not just barefoot people in worn woolens. A woman in silk and lace, standing beside one of the sedan chairs, quickly gathered half a dozen before gazing toward the noise, with the birds dangling from her hands by their feet. Olivia made a startled sound. "Is that ill luck or good?" she drawled. "It must be ill, unless pigeons here are different." Nynaeve gave her a sour look, but said nothing. She had been very quiet since Lan vanished the day before, a subject on which she was doubly silent.
"Some of those people are going to die of hunger," Min said sadly.
The bond quivered with sorrow.
"Every last one I can see something about."
"How can I hide?"
Luz Theron laughed.
"I am Tavirin."
"You're dead," Rant thought at him sharply. People in front of him were going to starve, and he laughed. There was nothing to be done, of course.
Not when Min spoke, but laughing was another matter. I am Taviran. Me. What else was happening in Tyr because of his presence? His being Taviran did not always have any effect at all, but when it did, the result could blanket an entire city. Best to get on with what he had come for before the wrong people figured out what things like pigeons flying into one another meant. If the Forsaken were sending armies of Trollocs and Murdral after him, it was likely that Dark Friends would take any opportunity to put an arrow through his ribs. Making little effort to hide was not the same as making no effort.
You might as well have brought the Banner of Light and an honor guard of thousands instead of six,
Cadswain murmured dryly, eyeing the maidens who were trying to pretend they had nothing to do with Rand's party while standing in a wide circle around it, Shufa covering their heads and veils hanging down their chests. Two were Shido, fierce-eyed whenever they looked at him. The maidens' spears were all on their backs, stuck through the harness of their bowcases, but only because Rand had offered to leave them behind and take someone else otherwise. Nandera had insisted on at least a few maidens, staring at him with eyes as hard as emeralds. He had never considered refusing. The only child of a maiden any maiden had ever known, he had obligations to meet. He gathered Tidaishar's reins, and abruptly a large wagon full of machinery came into sight, clanking and hissing, wide iron-studded wheels striking sparks from the gray paving stones as it moved along the street as fast as a man could trot. The machinery seemed to sweat steam. A heavy wooden shaft swung up and down, pushing another vertical shaft, and gray wood smoke drifted from a metal chimney. But there was no sign of a horse, just an odd sort of tiller in the front to turn the wheels. One of the three men standing in the wagon pulled a long cord, and steam rushed in a shrill whistle out of a tube atop a huge iron cylinder. If the onlookers stared in awe and maybe covered their ears, the fork-bearded merchant's team was in no such mood. Whinnying wildly, they bolted, scattering people as they ran and nearly pitching the man out on his head. Curses pursued them, and several braying mules that galloped off with their drivers in bouncing carts, sawing at the reins. Even a few oxen began to lumber along more quickly. Min's astonishment filled the bond. Controlling the black with his knees, trained as warhorse, Tidaishar responded immediately, though he still snorted. Rand stared in amazement, too. It seemed Master Pole actually had made his steam wagon work.
"But how did you get the thing to Tyr?" he asked the heir.
The last he had seen, it had been at the Academy of Kyrian, and seizing up every few paces.
"It's called a steam horse, my lord,"
a barefoot, dirty-faced urchin in a ragged shirt said, bouncing on the pavement. Even the sash holding up his baggy breeches seemed as much holes as cloth.
"I've seen it 9 times. Comhir's only seen it 7. "A steam wagon, Donnie," his equally ragged companion put in. "A steam wagon."
Neither of them could have been more than 10, and they were gaunt rather than skinny. Their muddy feet, torn shirts, and holed breeches meant they came from outside the walls, where the poorest folk lived. Rand had changed a number of laws in Tyr, especially those that weighed down heavily on the poor, but he had been unable to change everything. He had not even known how to begin. Luce Theron began to maunder on about taxes and money-creating jobs, but he might as well have been spilling out words at random for all the sense he made. Rand muted the voice to a buzz, a fly on the other side of a room.
4 of them hitched together, one behind the other, pulled 100 wagons all the way from Kyrian,
Donnie went on, ignoring the other boy.
They covered near 100 miles every day, my lord. 100 miles!
Calm sighed heavily.
There were 6 of them, Donnie, and they only pulled 50 wagons, but they covered more than 100 miles every day. 120 some days, I heard, and it was one of the steam men said it.
Donnie turned to scowl at him, the pair of them balling up fists.
Either way, it's a remarkable achievement,
Rand told them quickly, before they could begin trading blows.
Here.
Dipping into his coat pocket, he pulled out 2 coins and tossed 1 toward each boy without looking to see what they were. Gold glittered in the air before the boys eagerly snatched the coins. Exchanging startled glances, they went running out through the gates as fast as they could go, no doubt fearful he would demand the coins back. Their families could live for months on that much gold. Min gazed after them with an expression of misery that the bond echoed even after she shook her head and smoothed her face. What had she seen? Death, probably. Rand felt anger, but no sorrow. How many tens of thousands would die before the last battle was done? How many would be children? He had no room left in him for sorrow.
"Very generous," Nynaeve said in a tight voice. "But are we going to stand here all morning?"
The steam wagon was moving on out of sight quickly, yet her plump brown mare was still blowing anxiously and tossing her head, and she was having difficulty with the animal, placid as it was by nature. She was far from as good a rider as she thought herself. For that matter, Min's mount, an arch-necked gray mare from Elgaran's stables, danced so that only Min's firm red-gloved grip on the reins kept her from running. And Olivia's roan was trying to dance, though the former Damani controlled the animal as easily as Cadswain did her bay. Olivia sometimes displayed surprising talents. Damani were expected to ride well. As they rode into the city, Rant took a last glance at the disappearing steam wagon. Remarkable was hardly the word. 100 wagons are only 50. Only? Incredible was more like it. Would merchants start using those things instead of horses? It hardly seemed likely. Merchants were conservative folk, not known for leaping at new ways of doing things. For some reason, Luz Theron began laughing again. Tyr was not beautiful, like Camlann or Tarvalen, and few of its streets could be called particularly broad. But it was large and sprawling, one of the great cities of the world, and, like most great cities, a jumble that had grown up willy-nilly. In those tangled streets, tile-roofed inns and slate-roofed stables, the roof corners slanted sharply, stood alongside palaces with squared white domes and tall, balcony-ringed towers that often came to points, the heights of domes and towers gleaming in the early morning sun. Smithies and cutlers, seamstresses and butchers, fishmongers and rug-weavers' shops, rubbed against marble structures, with tall bronze doors behind massive white columns, guild halls and bankers' and merchants' exchanges. At this hour, the streets themselves were still cast in deep shadows, yet they bustled with that storied southern industry. Sedan chairs, borne by pairs of lean men, wove through the crowds almost as quickly as the children who raced about in play, while coaches and carriages behind teams of 4 or 6 moved as slowly as the carts and wagons, most drawn by large oxen. Porters trudged along, their bundles slung beneath poles carried on 2 men's shoulders, and apprentices carried rolled carpets and boxes of the master's handiwork on their backs. Hawkers cried their wares from trays or hand-barrows, pins and ribbons, a few with roasted nuts and meat pies, and tumblers or jugglers or musicians performed at nearly every intersection. You would never have thought this city was the site of a siege. Not everything was peaceful, though. Early morning or not, Rand saw obstreperous drunks being thrown out of inns and taverns, and so many fistfights and men wrestling on the pavement that it seemed one pair was not well out of sight before the next came into view. A good many obvious armsmen mingled in the crowd, swords at their hips and the fat sleeves of their woolen coats striped in various house colors, but even those wearing breastplates and helmets made no move to break up the rows. A fair number of the fights involved armsmen, with each other, with sea folk, with roughly clad fellows who might have been laborers or apprentices, or shoulder thumpers. Soldiers with nothing to do grew bored, and bored soldiers got drunk and fought. He was glad to see the rebels' armsmen bored. The maidens, drifting through the throng and still trying to pretend they had no association with Rand, drew puzzled looks and head-scratching, mainly from dark-faced sea folk, though a gaggle of children trailed after them gaping. The Tyrans, many of whom were not all that much fairer than the sea folk, had seen Aiel before, and if they wondered why they had returned to the city, it appeared they had different business at hand this morning, and more important. No one seemed to give Rand or his other companions a second glance. There were other mounted men and women in the streets, most of them outlanders, here a pale Kyrianan merchant in a somber coat, there an Arafelan with silver bells fastened to his dark braids, here a copper-skinned Domani, in a barely opaque riding dress, barely hidden by her cloak, followed by a pair of hulking bodyguards in leather coats sewn with steel discs, there a Shinaran with his head shaved except for a gray topknot, and his belly straining his buttons. You could not move 10 paces in Tyr without seeing outlanders. Tyran commerce had long arms. Which was not to say that he passed through the city without incident. Ahead of him, a running baker's boy tripped and fell, flinging his basket into the air, and when the boy levered himself off the paving stones as Rand rode by, he stopped halfway up with his mouth hanging open, staring at the long loaves, standing on end near the basket, propped together in a rough cone. A fellow in his shirt sleeves, drinking in a second-story window of an inn, overbalanced and toppled toward the street with a shriek that cut off when he landed on his feet not 10 paces from Tidashar, mug still in hand. Rand left him behind wide-eyed and feeling at himself in wonderment. Ripples of altered chance were following Rand through the city, spreading across the city. Not every event would be as harmless as the loaves or as beneficial as the man landing on his feet rather than his head. Those ripples could turn what should be a bruiseless tumble into broken bones or a broken neck. Lifelong feuds could be started by men speaking words they had never thought to hear come from their own lips. Women could decide to poison their husbands over trivial offenses they had tolerated complacently for years. Oh, some fellow might find a rotting sack full of gold buried in his own basement without really knowing why he had decided to dig in the first place. Or a man might ask and gain the hand of a woman he had never before had the courage to approach. But as many would find ruination as found good fortune. Balance, Min had called it. A good to balance every ill. He saw an ill to balance every good. He needed to be done in Tyr and gone as soon as possible. Galloping in those crowded streets was out of the question, but he picked up his pace enough that the maidens had to trot. His destination had been in sight since long before he entered the city, a mass of stone like a barren, sheer-sided hill that stretched from the river Arinon into the city's heart, covering at least 8 or 9 marches, a good square mile or more, and dominating the city's sky. The Stone of Tyr was mankind's oldest stronghold, the oldest structure in the world, made with the one power in the last days of the breaking itself. One solid piece of stone it was, without a single join, though better than 3,000 years of rain and wind had weathered the surface to roughness. The first battlements stood 100 paces above the ground, though there were arrow slits aplenty lower, and stone spouts for showering attackers with boiling oil or molten lead. No besieger could stop the stone from being supplied through its own wall-shielded docks, and it contained forges and manufactories to replace or mend every sort of weapon should its armories fall short. Its highest tower, rearing over the very center of the stone, held the banner of Tyr, half red, half gold, with a slanting line of 3 silver crescents, and so large that it could be made out plainly as it curled in a strong breeze. It had to be strong to move that flag. Lower towers supported smaller versions, but here they alternated with another rippling banner, the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai, black and white on a field of red. The Banner of Light, the Dragon Banner, some called it, as if there were not another that bore that name. The High Lord Darlan was flaunting his allegiance, it seemed. That was well. Alana was in there, and whether or not that was well, he would have to learn. He was not as sharply aware of her as before Elaine and Avienda and Min jointly bonded him. He thought he was not. They had pushed her aside to take primacy somehow, and she had told him she could sense little more of him than his presence. Yet she still lay in the back of his head, a bundle of emotions and physical sensations. It seemed a long time since he had been near enough to her to sense those. Once again the bond with her felt an intrusion, a would-be usurper of his bond to Min and Elaine and Avienda. Alana was weary, as if perhaps she had not been getting enough sleep lately, and frustrated, with strong streaks of anger and sulkiness. Were the negotiations going badly? He would find out soon enough. She would be aware he was in the city, aware he was coming closer, if little more. Min had tried to teach him a trick called masking that supposedly could hide him from the bond, but he had never been able to make it work. Of course, she admitted she had never been able to make it work either. Soon he found himself on a street that ran directly to the plaza that surrounded the stone on three sides, but he had no intention of riding straight there. For one thing, every massive iron-strapped gate would be barred tight. For another, he could see several hundred armsmen at the foot of the street. He expected there would be the same in front of every gate. They hardly gave the impression of men besieging a fortress. They seemed to be lounging about with no order. Many had their helmets off, and their halberds propped against the buildings lining the street, and serving women from nearby taverns and inns circulated among them selling mugs of ale or wine from trays. Yet it was highly unlikely they would remain complacent about anyone trying to enter the stone. Not that they could stop him, of course. He could sweep aside a few hundred men like so many moths. He had not come to Tyr to kill anyone, though, not unless he had to, so he rode into the stable yard of a tile-roofed inn, three stories of dark gray stone with a prosperous look. The sign out front was freshly painted with, of all things, a rough approximation of the creatures encircling his forearms. The artist apparently had decided the thing was inadequate as described, though, because he had added long, sharp teeth and leathery, ribbed wings. Wings! They almost looked copied from one of those Shonchan flying beasts. Cadswain looked at the sign and snorted. Nynaeve looked at it and giggled. So did Min. Even after Rand gave the barefoot stable boys silver to curry the horses, they stared at the maidens harder than at the coins, but no harder than the patrons stared in the dragon's beam-ceiling common room. Conversation trailed off when the maidens followed Rand and the others inside, spear points sticking up above their heads and bullhide bucklers in hand. Men and women, most in plain, if good quality wool, turned in their low-backed chairs to stare. They seemed to be middling merchants and solid craftsfolk, yet they gaped like villagers seeing a city for the first time. The serving women, in dark high-necked dresses and short white aprons, stopped trotting and goggled over their trays. Even the woman playing a hammered dulcimer between the two stone fireplaces, cold on this fine morning, fell silent. A very dark fellow with tightly curled hair, at a square table beside the door, seemed not to notice the maidens at all. Rand took him for one of the sea folk at first, though he wore a peculiar coat without collar or lapels, once white but now stained and wrinkled.
"I tell you, I have many of the worms that make, yes, make silk on a ship," he said haltingly in an odd musical accent. "But I must have the berry leaves to feed them. We will be rich."
His companion waved a plump, dismissive hand even while staring at the maidens.
"Worms," he said absently. "Everybody knows silk grows on trees." Walking deeper into the common room, Rand shook his head as the proprietor advanced to meet him. Worms. The tales people could come up with to try prying coin out of somebody.
"A garde s'arrange at your service, my lord, my ladies," the lean, balding man said with a deep bow, sweeping his hands wide. Not all Tyrans were dark by any means, but he was nearly as fair-complected as a Kyrianin.
"How may I serve?"
His dark eyes kept drifting to the maidens, and every time they did, he tugged at his long blue coat as though it suddenly felt too tight.
"We want a room with a good view of the stone," Rand said.
"It is worms that make silk, friend," a man drawled behind him. "My eyes on it."
At that familiar accent, Rand spun to find Olivia staring, wide-eyed and her face bloodless, at a man in a dark coat who was just passing through the doorway into the street. With an oath, Rand ran to the door, but there were close to a dozen men in dark coats walking away from the inn, any one of whom might have spoken. There was no way to pick out one man of average height and width, seen only from behind. What was a Shonchan doing in Tyr? Scouting for another invasion? He would put paid to that soon enough. But he turned from the door, wishing he could have laid hands on the man. Knowing would be better than having to guess. He asked Olivia whether she had gotten a good look at the fellow, but she shook her head silently. Her face was still pale. She was ferocious when she talked of what she wanted to do to Suldam, yet it seemed just hearing the accents of her native land was enough to shake her. He hoped that did not turn out to be weakness in her. She was going to help him somehow, and he could not afford her to be weak. "What do you know of this man who just left?" he demanded of Soranche. "The one with the slurred way of talking." The innkeeper blinked.
"Nothing, my lord. I've never seen him before." "You want one room, my lord?"
He ran his eyes over Min and the other women, and his lips moved as if he were counting.
"If you're thinking of any impropriety, Master Soranche," Nynaeve said indignantly, tugging at the braid hanging from the cowl of her cloak, "you had best think twice and again, before I box your ears."
Min hissed softly, and one hand drifted toward her other wrist before she checked the motion. Light, but she was quick to reach for her knives.
"What impropriety?" Olivia asked in tones of puzzlement.
Cadswain snorted.
"One room," Rand said patiently. Women can always find a reason to be indignant, he thought.
Or had that been Luce Theron? He shrugged in discomfort, and a touch of irritation that he only just managed to keep out of his voice.
"Your largest with a view of the stone. We don't want it for long. You'll be able to rent it out again for tonight. You may have to keep our horses a day or two, though."
A look of relief crept over Saranche's narrow face, though patently false rue filled his voice.
"I regret that my largest room is taken, my lord. In fact, all of my large rooms are taken, but I will be more than happy to escort you up the street to the Three Moons and—"
"Pfah!"
Cadswain pushed back her hood enough to reveal her face and some of her golden hair ornaments. She was all cool composure, her gaze implacable.
"I think you can find a way to make that room available, boy. I think you had better find a way. Pay him well," she added to Rand, ornaments swaying on their chains. "That was advice, not an order."
Saranche took Rand's fat golden crown with alacrity. It was doubtful the entire inn earned much more in a week. But it was Cadswain's ageless face that sent him bounding up the staircase at the back of the common room to return in a handful of minutes and show them to a room on the second floor with dark polished paneling and a rumpled bed wide enough for three, flanked by a pair of windows filled by the stone looming over the rooftops. The previous occupant had been hustled out so quickly that he had left a woolen stocking crumpled at the foot of the bed and a carved horn comb on the washstand in the corner. The innkeeper offered to have their saddlebags brought up, and wine, and seemed surprised when Rand refused, but one glance at Cadswain's face, and he bowed his way out again hurriedly. The room was fairly large as inn-rooms went, yet not compared to most chambers in Algarin's manor house, much less in a palace, especially not with near a dozen people filling the space. The walls seemed to close in on Rand. His chest suddenly felt tight. Every breath came with difficulty. The bond was suddenly full of sympathy and concern.
"The box," Luce Theron panted. "Have to get out of the box."
Keeping his eyes on the windows, being able to see the stone was a necessity, and seeing open air between the dragon and the stone, the open air above loosened his breathing a little. Just a little. Keeping his eyes fixed on the sky above the stone, he ordered everyone to stand against the walls. They obeyed with speed. Well, Cadswain gave him a sharp look before gliding to the wall, and Nynaeve sniffed before flouncing over, but the rest moved quickly. If they thought he wanted space for safety's sake, in a way he did. Having them out of his line of sight made the room seem a little larger. Only a little, yet every inch was a blessed relief. The bond was filled with concern.
"Must get out,"
Lutheran moaned.
"Have to get out."
Stiffening himself against what he knew would come, watchful of any attempt by Lutheran, Rant seized the male half of the true source and Cyadine flowed into him. Had the madman tried to seize it first? He had brushed it, certainly, touched it, but it was Rand's. Mountains of flame collapsing in fiery avalanches tried to scour him away. Waves that made ice seem warm tried to crush him in raging seas. He gloried in it, suddenly so alive it seemed he had been sleepwalking before. He could hear the breath of everyone in the room, could see that great banner atop the stone so clearly he almost thought he could make out the weave of the fabric. The double wound in his side throbbed as if trying to rip itself out of his body. But with the power filling him, he could ignore that pain. He thought he could have ignored a sword thrust. Yet with Cyadine came the inevitable violent nausea, the almost overwhelming desire to double over and empty himself of every meal he had ever eaten. His knees trembled with it. He fought that as hard as he fought the power, and Cyadine had to be fought ever and always. A man forced Cyadine to his will, or it destroyed him. The face of the man from Shadow Logoth floated in his head for a moment. He looked furious, and near to sicking up. Without any doubt, he was aware of Rand in that moment, and Rand of him. Move a hair in any direction, and they would touch. No more than a hair. "What's the matter?" Nynaeve demanded, moving close and peering up at him in concern. "Your face has gone all gray." She reached for his head, and his skin popped out in goosebumps. He brushed her hands away. "I'm all right. Stand clear." She stood there, giving him one of those looks women carried in their belt pouches. This one said she knew he was lying, even if she could not prove it. Did they practice those looks in front of mirrors? "Stand clear, Nynaeve."
"He's all right, Nynaeve,"
Min said, though her face had a touch of gray about it too, and she had both red-gloved hands pressed to her middle. She knew. Nynaeve sniffed at him, wrinkling her nose in disdain, but she finally moved out of his way. Maybe Lan had had enough and run away. No, not that. Lan would not leave her unless she told him to, and then only for as long as was needful. Wherever he was, Nynaeve knew, and likely had sent him there for reasons of her own. Aes Sedai and their bloody secrets. He channeled, spirit touched with fire, and the familiar vertical silvery slash appeared at the foot of the bed, seemed to rotate into a dim view of massive columns in darkness. Light from the in-room gave all the illumination. The opening, standing inches above the floor, was no larger than the door to the room, yet as soon as it was fully open, three of the maidens, already veiled, darted through, pulling spears free, and Rand's skin pebbled again as Olivia leaped after them. Protecting him was a self-imposed duty, but one she took as seriously as the maidens did. There would be no ambush here, though, no dangers, so he stepped through and down. At the other end, the gateway sat more than a foot above the huge gray slabs of stone that he had not wanted to damage any more than he already had. This was the heart of the stone, and with the power in him, and the light spilling from the gateway from the room in the dragon, he could see the narrow hole in one of those stones where he had driven Kalendor into the floor. Who draws it out shall follow after. He had thought long and hard before sending Narishma to bring Kalendor to him. However, the prophecies meant the man was to follow. Narishma was otherwise occupied today. A forest of immense redstone columns surrounded him, stretching up into the dark that hid the unlit golden lamps and the vaulted ceiling and the great dome. His boots echoed hollowly in the vast chamber, and even the whispers of the maidens' soft boots. In this space, the sense of confinement vanished. Min hopped down right behind him, with a throwing knife in either hand, and her head swiveling, eyes searching the darkness, but Cadswain, standing at the edge of the gateway, said,
"I don't jump unless I absolutely have to, boy."
She held out a hand, waiting for him to take it. He handed her down, and she nodded thanks. It could have been meant for thanks. It could have meant you took your bloody time about it, too. A ball of light appeared over her upturned palm, and a moment later Olivia was balancing a globe of light, too. The pair created a pool of brightness that turned the surrounding darkness deeper. Nynaeve required the same courtesy, and had the grace to murmur thanks. She quickly gained her own ball of light. But when he offered a hand to one of the maidens, he thought it was Sarendra, one of the Shido, though all he could see of her face was blue eyes above her black veil. She grunted contemptuously and leaped down, spear in hand, followed by the other two. He let the gateway close, but held on to Sayadin, despite the roiling in his stomach and head. He did not expect to need to channel again before he left the stone, yet he did not want to give Luz Theron another opportunity to seize the power either.
"You have to trust me," Luz Theron snarled. "If we're going to make it to Tarmangaiden so we can die, you have to trust me."
"You told me once not to trust anyone," Rand thought, "including you." "Only madmen trust no one," Luz Theron whispered. Abruptly, he began to weep.
"Oh, why do I have a madman in my head?"
Rand pushed the voice away. On striding through the tall arch that led from the heart, he was surprised to find two defenders of the stone in ridged helmets and shining breastplates, the puffy sleeves of their black coats striped in black and gold. Swords drawn, they were staring at the archway with expressions that combined confusion with grim resolution. Doubtless, they had been startled to see lights and hear footsteps echoing in a room with only one entrance, an entrance they were guarding. The maidens crouched, spears coming up, spreading out to either side, slowly curling in toward the pair.
"By the stone, it's him!"
one of the men said, sheathing his sword hurriedly. Stocky, with a puckered scar that began on his forehead and journeyed across the bridge of his nose and down to his jaw, he bowed deeply, hands in steel-backed gauntlets spreading wide.
"My lord dragon," he said. "Jagenhander, my lord. The stone stands. I got this that day."
He touched the scar on his face. "An honorable wound, Handar, and a day to remember," Rand told him as the other, leaner man hastily put up his blade and bowed. Only then did the maidens lower their spears, but their faces remained veiled. A day to remember? Trollocs and Murdral inside the stone. The second time he had truly wielded Kalendor, using the sword that was not a sword as it was meant to be used. The dead lying everywhere, a dead girl he could not make live again. Who could forget such a day? "I know I gave orders for the heart to be guarded while Kalendor was there, but why are you still standing guard?" The two men exchanged puzzled looks.
"You gave the order to set guards, my lord dragon," Handar said, "and the defenders obey. But you never said anything about Kalendor except that no one was to approach it unless they had proof they came from you."
Suddenly the stocky man gave a start and bowed again, more deeply still.
"Forgive me, my lord, if I seem to question you. I don't mean to. Shall I summon the High Lords to your apartments? Your rooms have been kept in readiness for your return."
"No need," Rand told him. "Darlin will be expecting me, and I know where to find him." Handar winced. The other man suddenly found something interesting on the floor to study.
"You may require a guide, my lord," Handar said slowly. "The corridors. Sometimes the corridors change."
So, the pattern truly was loosening. That meant the Dark One was touching the world more than he had since the War of the Shadow. If it loosened too much before Tarmangaiden, the Age Lace might unravel. An end to time and reality and creation. Somehow he had to bring about the last battle before that happened. Only he did not dare. Not yet. He assured Handar and the other man that he needed no guide, and the pair of them bowed yet again, apparently accepting the Dragon Reborn could do anything he said he could do. In simple truth, he knew he could locate Alana. He could have pointed straight at her. And she had moved since he first felt her. To find Darlin and inform him that Randall Thor was approaching, he was sure. Min had named her as one he held in his hand, yet Aes Sedai always found a way to play both ends against the middle. They always had schemes of their own, goals of their own. Witness Nynaeve and Varen. Witness any of them.
"They hop when you say toad," Cadswain said coolly, pushing the cowl of her cloak down her back, as they walked away from the heart. "That can be bad for you, when too many people jump at your word."
She had the nerve to say that. Cadswain bloody Maladrin? "I'm fighting a war," he told her harshly. The nausea had his temper on edge. That was part of the reason he was harsh. "The fewer people who obey, the more chance I'll lose, and if I lose, everybody loses. If I could make everybody obey, I would." There were far too many who did not obey as it was, or obeyed in their own way. Why in the light would Min feel pity? Cadswain nodded.
"As I thought," she murmured half to herself.
And what was that supposed to mean? The stone had all the trappings of a palace, from silk tapestries and rich runners in the corridors, from Terabon and Eltara and Tyr itself, to golden stands holding mirrored lamps. Chests standing against the stone walls might be for storing what the servants needed for cleaning, yet they were of rare woods, often elaborately carved and always with gilded banding. Niches held bowls and vases of seafolk porcelain, thin as leaves and worth many times their weight in gold, or massive gem-studded figures. A golden leopard with ruby eyes trying to pull down a silver deer with pearl-covered antlers that stood a pace tall. A golden lion that was even taller, with emerald eyes and fire drops for claws. Others set so extravagantly with gems that no metal showed. Servants in black and gold livery bowed or curtsied as Rand climbed through the stone, those who recognized him very deeply indeed. Some eyes widened at the sight of the maidens trailing behind, but their surprise never slowed their curtsies. All the trappings of a palace, yet the stone had been designed for war within as well as without. Wherever two corridors crossed, murder holes dotted the ceiling. Between the tapestries, arrow slits pierced the walls high up, angled to cover the corridors in both directions, and no flight of sweeping stairs, but had arrow slits placed so the staircase could be swept by arrows or crossbow bolts. Only one assailant had ever succeeded in forcing a way into the stone, the Aiel, and they had swept over the opposition too quickly for many of those defenses to come into play. But any other enemy that managed to get inside the stone would pay a price in blood for every hallway. Except that traveling had changed warfare forever. Traveling and blossoms of fire and so much more. That blood price would still be paid, yet stone walls and high towers could no longer hold back an assault. The Ashaman had made the stone as obsolete as the bronze swords and stone axes men had often been reduced to in the breaking. Mankind's oldest stronghold was now a relic. The bond with Alana led him up and up until he came to tall, polished doors with golden leopards for door handles. She was on the other side. Light, but his stomach wanted to empty itself. Hardening himself, he pulled open one of the doors and went in, leaving the maidens to stand guard. Min and the others followed him in. The sitting room was almost as ornate as his own apartments in the stone. The walls hung with broad silk tapestries, showing scenes of the hunt and battle, the large patterned terabana carpet on the floor, worth sufficient gold to feed a large village for a year, the black marble fireplace tall enough for a man to walk into and wide enough to hold 8 abreast. Every piece of furnishing, all massively made, was elaborately carved, crusted with gilt and dotted with gems, as were the tall golden stand lamps, their mirrored flames adding to the light let in by the glass-paned ceiling. A golden bear with ruby eyes and silver claws and teeth, more than a pace high, stood atop a gilded plinth on one side of the room, while an identical plinth held an emerald-eyed, ruby-taloned eagle nearly as tall. restrained pieces for Tyr. Seated in an armchair, Alana looked up as he walked in and held out a golden goblet for one of the two young serving women in black and gold to fill with dark wine from a tall golden pitcher. Slender in a gray riding dress slashed with green, Alana was beautiful enough that Luz-Theron began humming to himself. Rand almost thumbed his earlobe before snatching his hand down, suddenly unsure whether that gesture was his or the madman's. She smiled, but darkly, and as her eyes swept across Min and Nynaeve, Olivia and Cadswain, the bond carried her suspicion, not to mention anger and sulkiness. The last two heightened for Cadswain. And there was joy as well, mixed in all the rest, when her gaze touched him. Not that it showed in her voice.
"Why, who would have expected you, my lord dragon?" she murmured with a hint of asperity in the title. "Quite a surprise, wouldn't you say, my lord Asteril?"
So she had not warned anyone after all. Interesting.
"A very pleasant surprise," an elderly man in a coat with red and blue striped sleeves said as he rose to bow, stroking his oiled beard, trimmed to a point. The High Lord Astral Damara's face was creased, the hair that hung to his shoulders snow-white and thinning, but his back was straight and his dark eyes sharp.
"I've been looking forward to this day for some time."
He bowed again to Cadswain and, after a moment, to Nynaeve.
"Aes Sedai," he said.
Very civil for Tyr, where channeling, if not Aes Sedai themselves, had been outlawed before Rand altered the law. Darlin Cisnera, High Lord and Steward in Tyr for the Dragon Reborn, in a green silk coat with yellow-striped sleeves and gold-worked boots, was less than a head shorter than Rand, with close-cut hair and a pointed beard, a bold nose and blue eyes that were rare in Tyr. Those eyes widened as he turned from a conversation with Caroline Damodred near the fireplace. The Kyrianan noblewoman gave Rand a jolt, though he had expected to see her here. The litany he used to forge his soul in fire almost started up in his head before he could stop it. Short and slim and pale, with large dark eyes and a small ruby dangling onto her forehead from a golden chain, woven into the black hair falling in waves to her shoulders, she was the very image of her cousin Moiraine. Of all things, she wore a long blue coat embroidered in golden scrolls except for the horizontal stripes of red, green, and white that ran from neck to hem over snug green breeches and heeled blue boots. It seemed the fashion had traveled after all. She made a curtsy, even so, though it looked odd in that garb. Luz-Theron hummed even harder, making Rand wish the man had a face so he could hit him. Moiraine was a memory for hardening his soul, not for humming at.
"My lord dragon," Darlin said, bowing stiffly.
He was not a man accustomed to offering the first curtsy. He gave no bow for Cadswain, just a sharp look before he seemed to dismiss her presence entirely. She kept him and Caroline as guests, for a time in Kyrian. He was unlikely to forget that, or forgive. At his gesture, the two serving women moved quickly to offer wine. As might have been expected, Cadswain, with her ageless face, received the first goblet, but surprisingly, Nynaeve got the second. The dragon reborn was one thing, a woman wearing the great serpent ring, something else again, even in Tyr. Throwing her cloak back, Cadswain retreated to the wall. It was unlike her to be retiring, but then from there she could observe everyone at once. Olivia took a place by the door, doubtless for much the same reason.
"I am glad to see you better than when I saw you last," Darlin went on. "You've done me great honor, though I may yet lose my head for it if your Aes Sedai make no more progress than they have."
"Don't be sulky, Darlin," Caroline murmured, her throaty voice sounding amused. "Men do sulk, do they not, men?"
For some reason, Min barked a laugh.
"What are you doing here?" Rand demanded of the two people he had not expected to see.
He took a goblet from one of the serving women while the other hesitated between Min and Olivia. Min won out, perhaps because Olivia's blue dress was plain. Sipping her wine, Min strolled over to Caroline. At a glance from the Kyrianan woman, Darlin moved away, grinning, and the two women stood with their heads together, whispering. Filled with the power, Rand could catch the occasional word. His name, Darlin's. Wireman Santiago, also a High Lord of Tyr, was not short, and he stood as straight as a sword, yet there was something of a strutting rooster about him. His gray-streaked beard, trimmed to a point and oiled, practically quivered with pride.
"Hail to the Lord of the Morning," he said, bowing, or rather he intoned it.
Wireman was a great one for intoning and declaiming.
"Why am I here, my Lord Dragon?"
He sounded puzzled at the question.
"Why, when I heard that Darlin was besieged in the stone, what could I do but come to his aid? Burn my soul, I tried to talk some of the others into accompanying me. We'd have put a quick end to Estanda and that lot, I vow."
He clutched a fist to demonstrate how he would have crushed the rebels.
"But only Anaella had the courage. The Kyrianan were a complete lot of lily hearts."
Caroline paused her talk with Min to give him a look that would have had him hunting for the stab wound had he noticed it. Astral pursed his lips and commenced a study of his wine. The High Lady Anaella Narancelona also wore a coat and snug breeches with heeled boots, though she had added a white lace ruff, and her green coat was sewn with pearls. A close cap of pearls sat atop her dark hair. A slim, pretty woman, she offered a simpering curtsy and somehow made it seem she wanted to kiss Rand's hand. Courage was not a word he would have applied to her. Nerve, on the other hand.
"My Lord Dragon," she cooed, "I wish we could report complete success, but my master of the horse died fighting the Seanchan, and you left most of my armsmen in Ilion. Still we managed to strike a blow in your name."
"Success? A blow?" Alana's scowl took in Wireman and Anaella both before she twisted back around to face Rand. "They landed at the Stone's docks with one ship, but they put most of their armsmen and all the mercenaries they hired in Kyrian ashore from the rest upriver, with orders to enter the city and attack the rebels." She made a sound of disgust. "The only result was a great many men dead, and our negotiations with the rebels thrown back to the beginning." Anaella's simper took on a sickly twist.
"My plan was to sortie from the stone and attack them from both sides," Wireman protested. "Darlin refused. Refused!"
Darlin was not grinning now. He stood with his feet apart and looked a man who wished he had a sword in his hand rather than a goblet.
"I told you then, Wireman, if I stripped the stone of defenders, the rebels would still have outnumbered us badly. Too badly. They've hired every sellsword from the Aranin to the Bay of Ramara."
Rand took a chair, flinging one arm over the back. The heavy arms had no supports at the front, so his sword was no problem. Caroline and Min seemed to have switched their talk to clothing. At least, they were fingering each other's coats, and he heard words like backstitch and bias cut, whatever that meant. Alana's gaze drifted between him and Min, and he felt disbelief warring with suspicion along the bond.
"I left you two in Kyrian because I wanted you in Kyrian," he said.
He trusted neither, but they could cause small harm in Kyrian, where they were outlanders without power. Anger, heated by nausea, entered his voice.
"You will make plans to return there as soon as possible. As soon as possible!"
Anaella's simper grew more sickly, and she cringed slightly. Wireman was made of sterner stuff.
"My Lord Dragon, I will serve you where you command, but I can serve best on my native soil. I know these rebels, know where they can be trusted and where—" "As soon as possible!"
Rand snapped, slamming his fist down on the chair arm hard enough to make the wood creak loudly.
"One," Cadswain said, quite clearly and quite incomprehensibly. "I strongly suggest you do as he says, Lord Wireman."
Nynaeve eyed Wireman blandly, took a sip of wine.
"He has a temper lately, worse than ever,
and you don't want it directed at you." Cadswain exhaled a heavy breath. "Stay out of this, girl," she said sharply. Nynaeve glared at her, opened her mouth, then grimaced and closed it again. Gripping her braid, she glided across the carpet to join Min and Caroline. She had gotten very good at gliding. Wireman studied Cadswain for a moment, tilting back his head so he was staring down his nose.
"As the dragon reborn commands," he said finally, "so does Wireman Saniago obey. My ship can be ready to sail by tomorrow, I wager. Will that suffice?"
Rant nodded curtly. It would have to answer. He was not about to waste a moment making a gateway to send this pair of fools where they belong today. "There's hunger in the city," he said, eyeing the golden bear. How many days would that much gold feed Tyr? The thought of food made his stomach clench. And waited for a response that was quick in coming, if not from the direction he expected.
"Darlin had cattle and sheep herded down to the city," Caroline said with some considerable warmth. Rand was the one getting the dagger look now. "These days..." She faltered for a moment, though the heat never left her gaze. "These days, meat is inedible 2 days after slaughter, so he had the animals brought and wagons full of grain. Estonda and her companions seized it all for themselves." Darlin gave her a fond smile, but his voice was apologetic.
"I've tried 3 times, but Estonda is greedy, it seems. I saw no point in continuing to supply my enemies, your enemies."
Rand nodded. At least the man was not ignoring the situation in the city.
"There are 2 boys who live outside the walls, Donnie and Com. I don't know any more name than that. About age 10. Once the rebels are settled, and you can leave the stone, I would appreciate it if you found them and kept an eye on them."
Min made a sound in her throat, and the bond carried sadness so bleak it almost overwhelmed the burst of love that came with it. So, it must have been death she saw. But she had been wrong about Moraine. Maybe this viewing could be changed by a Taviran.
"No," Luce Theron growled. "Her viewings must not change. We have to die."
Rand ignored him. Darlin appeared puzzled by the request, but he acceded, as what else was he to do when the Dragon Reborn made it? Rand was about to bring up the purpose of his visit when Bera Harkin, another of the Aes Sedai he had sent to Tyr to deal with the rebels, entered the room frowning over her shoulder as if the maidens had made some difficulty for her. They might well have. The Aiel considered the Aes Sedai sworn to him to be Wise One's apprentices, and maidens took every opportunity to remind apprentices that they were not Wise Ones yet. She was a stocky woman with brown hair cut close around a square face, and despite her green silks, lacking Aes Sedai agelessness, she would have looked a farm wife. A farm wife who ruled her house and farm with a firm hand, though, and would tell a king not to track mud into her kitchen. She was Green Aja, after all, with every scrap of Green Aja pride and haughtiness. She frowned at Olivia, too, with all the disdain of Aes Sedai for Wilder, and that faded only to coolness when she caught sight of Rand.
"Well, I must say I shouldn't be surprised to see you, considering what's happened this morning," she said.
Unpinning her simple silver cloak brooch, she fastened it to her belt pouch and folded the cloak over her arm.
"Though it might have been the news that the others are no more than a day west of the Aranin."
"The others?"
Rand said quietly. Quietly and steely hard. Bera did not seem impressed. She went on arranging the folds of her cloak.
"The other high lords and ladies, of course. Sunaman, Tolmaran, all of them. Apparently, they're traveling hot foot for Tyr as fast as their armsmen's horses can move."
Rand leaped up so fast that his sword bound for a moment on the chair arm. Only a moment, because the gilded wood, weakened by his earlier blow, split with a loud crack and the arm dropped to the carpet. He never so much as glanced at it. The fools! The Seanchan at the border with Altara, and they were coming back to Tyr?
"Doesn't anybody remember how to obey?" he thundered.
I want messengers sent to them immediately. They're to return to Ilion faster than they left, or I'll have the lot of them hanged.
Two, Cadswain said. What in the light was she counting? A bit of advice, boy. Ask her what happened this morning. I smell good news.
Bera gave a little start at realizing Cadswain was in the room. Eyeing her sideways and cautiously, she stopped fiddling with her cloak.
"We've reached agreement," she said, as if the question had been asked. "Tadosian and Simon were wavering, as usual, but Hearn was nearly as adamant as Istanda."
She shook her head.
"I think Tadosian and Simon might have come around sooner, but some fellows with strange accents have been promising them gold and men."
"Sean Chan," Nynaeve said. Olivia opened her mouth, then closed it without speaking.
"They might be," Bera allowed. "They keep clear of us and look at us like we were mad dogs that might bite any moment. That sounds like what little I've heard of Sean Chan. In any case, less than an hour gone, Istanda suddenly began asking whether the Lord Dragon would restore her title and lands, and they all collapsed right behind her. The agreement is this. Darlin is accepted as steward in Tyr for the Dragon Reborn. All laws you made remain unchanged, and they pay for feeding the city for 1 year as a fine for rebellion. In return, they receive full restoration. Darlin is crowned king of Tyr, and they swear fealty to him. Mirana and Rafella are preparing the documents for signatures and seals."
"King?"
Darlin said incredulously. Caroline swayed over to take his arm.
"Restoration?" Rand growled, hurling his goblet aside in a spray of wine.
The bond carried caution, a warning from Min, but he was too angry to pay heed. The sickness twisting his insides twisted his rage, too.
"Blood and bloody ashes, I stripped them of lands and titles for rebelling against me. They can stay commoners and swear fealty to me."
"Three," Cadswain said, and Rand's skin popped out in goosebumps an instant before something struck him across the bottom like a hard-swung switch. Bera's lips parted in shock, and the cloak slid off her arm to the floor. Nynaeve laughed. She smothered it quickly, but she laughed.
"Don't make me have to keep reminding you about manners, boy," Cadswain went on. "Alana told me the terms you offered before she left. Darlin is steward, your laws kept, everything else on the table. And it seems they've been met. You can do as you wish, of course, but another piece of advice. When the terms you offer are accepted, hold to them."
"Else no one will trust you," Luce Theron said, sounding entirely sane, for the moment.
Rand glared at Cadswain, fists clenched, on the brink of weaving something that would singe her. He could feel a welt on his bottom, and would feel it more in the saddle. It seemed to pulse, and his anger pulsed with it. She peered back calmly over her wine. Was there a hint of challenge in her gaze, of daring him to channel? The woman spent every moment in his presence challenging him. The trouble was, her advice was good. He had given Alana those terms. He had expected them to bargain harder, gain more, but they had gotten what he actually asked for. More. He had not thought of fines.
"It seems your fortunes have risen, King Darlin," he said.
One of the serving women curtsied and handed Rand another full goblet of wine. Her face was as calm as any Aes Sedai's. You might have thought men arguing with sisters was a matter of every day with her.
"All hail, King Darlin,"
Wireman intoned, sounding half-strangled, and after a moment, Anaella echoed him, as breathless as if she had run a mile. Once she had talked of herself for a crown in Tyr.
"But why would they want me as king?" Darlin said, scrubbing a hand through his hair. "Or anyone? There have been no kings in the Stone since Moraina died 1,000 years ago. Or did you demand that, Bera Sedai?"
Bera straightened from picking up her cloak and began shaking it out.
"It was their demand would be too strong.
Their suggestion, any of them would have leapt at the chance of a throne, especially Astanda.
Anaella made a choking sound.
But of course they knew there was no hope of that. This way they can swear to you instead of to the dragon reborn, making it slightly less distasteful.
And if you are king, Caroline put in, it means that steward in tier for the Lord Dragon becomes a lesser title. She laughed throatily. They may even tack on 3 or 4 more noble-sounding titles to try pushing it down to obscurity. Bera pursed her lips as though she had been about to bring up that very point.
And would you marry a king, Caroline? Darlin asked. I'll accept the crown if you will, though I'll have to have a crown made.
Min cleared her throat.
I can tell you how it should look, if you like.
Caroline laughed again and released Darlin's arm, swaying away from him.
I will have to see you in it before I could answer that. Have Min's crown made, and if it makes you look pretty, she smiled, then perhaps I will consider it.
I wish you both the best, Rand said curtly, but there are more important matters to go into right now.
Min gave him a sharp look, disapproval flooding the bond. Nynaeve gave him a sharp look. What was that about?
You will accept that crown, darling, and as soon as those documents are signed, I want you to arrest those Seanchan. Then gather every man in Tyr who knows one end of sword or halberd from the other. I'll arrange for Ashaman to take you to Arad Daman.
And me, my lord dragon?
Wireman asked avidly. He all but quivered with eagerness, managing to strut while standing still.
If there is fighting to be done, I can serve you better there than languishing in Kyrian.
Rand studied the man, and Anaella. Wireman was a bungling idiot, and he trusted neither, but he could not see what harm they could do with no more than a handful of followers.
Very well, you two may accompany the High Lord, that is, King Darlin.
Anaella gulped as though she, for one, would rather return to Kyrian.
But what am I supposed to do in Arad Daman? Darlin wanted to know. The little I've heard of that land, it's a madhouse.
Luz Theron laughed wildly in Rand's head. Tommen Gaiden is coming soon, Rand said. The light sent not too soon.
You are going to Arad Daman to get ready for Tommen Gaiden.